Welcome, listeners, one and all. Welcome to Regency Rumours, the podcast where a British-American couple recap and discuss Bridgerton, the Regency Netflix show. I'm Jordan.
And I'm Kayla, and we are a month away from season 3 of Bridgerton. I can't believe how long we've had to wait. It was back in, what, December that they announced it? I think everybody thought it was going to be in 2023. And then when they said, oh no, 2024, people thought, well, maybe February around Valentine's Day, because Bridgerton is quite a romantic show, but...
Is it?
But no!
It was a crime drama.
I mean, let me tell you, this next season, maybe with Penelope being exposed as Lady Whistledown, if that happens...
Spoiler!
I don't know if that's what they're going to do in this season,
yeah,
but if
no,
they do...
Right, because we don't know exactly what they're going to be doing, but we assume, don't we?
But there could be any number of crimes. It could be Eloise being mad at Penelope. It could be Penelope being mad at Colin. It could be Colin being mad at Penelope, you know? Maybe this could change into a
show. Just describe the romance genre. I think the characters are definitely going to be mad at each other at some point, probably at multiple points. That is definitely something that we can expect. But you're right. It is definitely a little bit longer than we perhaps thought.
Yeah.
Wait, do we have a release date?
We do, yes. It's May 16th.
Ooh.
May 16th. But it's in two parts. And we've kind of talked about this before, being annoyed at this whole two-part thing. We did a Regency Rumors update a couple of months ago and talked about the two-part thing. Yeah, it's going to be annoying, I feel like. But let's be honest, we're going to watch it in two parts.
Yeah, because we have to. You know that whole, like, vote with your dollar type thing where it's like, well, just don't give them your business. In this case, don't watch it if you're annoyed. We kind of have to. They've got us over a barrel here, so we're gonna have to watch it in two parts. But the two parts thing is just not good, but whatever.
Yeah, unfortunately that means that the second part of this won't come out until June. I think it's June 18th, something like that. So really the whole series won't be out until June 18th. 17th or 18th. So talking a good 6 to 8 months between them announcing it and it coming out. So if you didn't know, Regency Rumors is on TikTok. We're on YouTube. We're very small on YouTube, but we are growing as we can make videos. It's very time consuming to do something like that. Really applaud people that have the time to edit YouTube videos regularly. But we are on TikTok and we're making fun content around period dramas and the history to do with period dramas, which is why episodes like this are so fun. So yeah, check us out on there. We're on Instagram and Facebook and all that fun stuff. If you are new to the podcast, this is our short, fun series called Beyond Bridgerton, where we explore different historical aspects of the series. And we have three episodes of this. So the first episode was with Richie Wedge, who is a sewing enthusiast. He talks a lot about Regency fashion. And we talked about Bridgerton costumes compared to other period dramas and historical Regency attire. So each of these episodes between now and the time that Bridgerton comes out on May 15th, 16th, whatever it is, we are going to be exploring some real life history compared to Bridgerton. So the second episode here, we are interviewing Dr. Zoe Chadwick, and her research is on disability in, I think, the Victorian era as well as the Georgian era. And this episode is going to be really interesting. We interviewed her back right after season one. And because we're mostly a recap podcast, we were trying to think of the best time to bring out the episode with her. And I'm really glad now that we're able to do it in this way where we can explore different topics of history. But you don't want to miss out on this episode. We're going to go back to season one. There's a lot of people that are recapping Bridgerton at the minute. They're going through an episode a week or something through season one and season two and Queen Charlotte in time to line it up with the premiere. So Netflix has put out a schedule and then people are following it, which I think is pretty cute. But yeah, so season one and season two are back on people's minds again. And in this episode, we talk to Zoe about what it would have been like for the Duke to grow up with a disability. What would it really have been like in the Regency era? And we talk about King George as well. I know that series, Queen Charlotte, really covered disability even in a bigger way than the first season of Bridgerton. And so we talk about King George and the disability that he may have had. We don't really know what it was, but how life would have been like for him. We talk about things like, I think, St. asylums and freak shows. And yeah, it was a harsh life for people with disability, but it's great that someone like her can bring awareness to it and understanding to what it would have been like for people with disabilities at the time. So I found this episode to be a really insightful one, and it gives you an idea of how people like the Duke or King George maybe would have made decisions on their lives based on the difficulties that they were going through or the ways that they had to deal with their disability in a time that wasn't so understanding for them. So we're excited about this episode. On to talking with Dr. Zoe Chadwick. Today is a special episode where we are diving into a topic that was at the forefront for season one, the Duke's speech impediment, where we see he's ostracized by his father and he spends many years trying to escape his impediment and how what happened to him shaped his relationships in his life. On this episode, we're going to be exploring the Duke's speech impediment, ableism, and representations of disability in the entertainment industry. We're excited that we're joined by Dr. Zoe Chadwick for this episode. She has a PhD in Victorian literary and medical discourse on disability and deformity. Dr. Chadwick has published articles on the late Victorian female asylum patient and the use of Gothic descriptive discourse in the Victorian medical text. Finally, like us, Zoe is a fellow period drama fan. Thank you, Zoe, for joining us today.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me. That was a very academic introduction of me, but yeah, it's nice to be here.
Okay, so this period drama thing is something kind of relatively new for me since Kayla and I have kind of gotten together.
I forced you to watch some period dramas.
Yeah, but you know, it over time has turned into something that wasn't forced. So you are a longtime fan of period dramas. So what is it about period dramas that you kind of really enjoy?
I mean, I can't believe she had to force you, Jordan. But for me, this has been a long time hobby, I suppose. But that's because I've been into history for a long time. My undergraduate degree was literature, but that kind of comes hand in hand with history anyway. I've always read historical drama novels. So the jump to television made sense, especially things like Bridgerton, because obviously it was the book first. Just before we started recording this, I was watching Downton Abbey. So it's a natural progression for me.
Definitely. So what did you think of season two of Bridgerton?
I enjoyed season two. I've seen a couple of reviews online where people are saying that the love story is quite heavy-handed, but I actually really enjoyed it. I think the kind of will they, won't they was a little bit predictable, but that's part of the fun of any period drama, that, you know, the courtship is what makes the love stories interesting. And of course, Bridgerton, unlike any other period drama, do diversity so beautifully. The way they represented it in season two was similar to season one. They did a really great job. The only thing I felt was missing was there wasn't much disability representation. We had that little bit with Simon in season one, but we do still get to see Anthony's experience of witnessing his father's passing. So although we don't see much disability, you do see that kind of medical anxiety still. There's still that sense of how much of a problem lack of medical knowledge was during the Regency period. So yeah, I loved it. I really enjoyed season two, but you know, more disability representation in future seasons would be nice for me to see. But yeah, no, I enjoyed it.
In the right direction with, like you said, the diversity in casting has been fantastic in terms of race. So yeah, some disability representation would also be amazing.
Absolutely.
So can you tell us a bit about your PhD research in Victorian literature? What made you want to study this? And what made you interested in studying ableism in the past?
I won't go into too much of my research because that could be a conversation for another day. But essentially, the short version is that my PhD itself focused on the later decades of the 19th century and was mostly focused on freak show performers and how they were treated medically versus in periodicals and literature. So it was a comparison of the two different types of medical versus societal treatment. But my research in historical ableism has spanned from early treatment of women in mental health facilities and right up to the changing attitudes towards deformity throughout the century and into the early 20th, which largely was dictated by war, because as more soldiers came home with amputations and military kind of ailments, disability was more recognized as an issue and more resources were provided, people were more accepted in society. It was seen as less of a something to be ashamed of. It was more widely accepted. So I've spanned the entire 19th century, really, in terms of my research, which has been lovely. The reason why I was interested in historical ableism in the first place was my master's degree was on representations of female mental health. And then over the following years, I developed a chronic illness myself, and my husband is a wheelchair user. So it has a personal pull for us as well. There is a culture and a kind of sense of community within the disabled and chronically ill community, both here and in most countries. Social media is a big platform for the chronic illness and disability community. So it's like the history of our community really has a big personal pull for us. So it's, yeah, become really interesting for me over the years.
Fair enough. So you mentioned in the article that you wrote that wealthy families were made to feel guilty to part with large sums of money to kind of cure their children. So who was doing this guilt trip, and do we know what they were doing to kind of supposedly cure people of these speech impediments? Does it have any basis in what a modern speech therapist might help with today?
So the larger feeling of kind of guilt wasn't done by any one person in particular. In general, obviously, I'm sure there were families where there was one person putting more pressure on them than others to correct these kind of ailments, correct in kind of inverted commas. But it was more of a larger societal problem. The feeling of guilt came from the implication of inadequacy, essentially. Any disability or ailment was seen as some sense of genetic inadequacy, which for wealthy families, like we see in Bridgerton, particularly in Simon's case, the entire principle of hereditary, you know, inheritance and inheriting huge sums of money hung on these bloodlines being pure. So the hereditary principle was already so hard to justify. These hugely wealthy estates and aristocratical families passed down titles and money based purely on the fact that they were born into the correct family, which when people were going hungry is very hard to justify as it is. And then there's a supposed, again in commas, problem with that bloodline, and it becomes further hard to justify. So the guilt was more of a larger societal problem that these wealthy families had a firstborn son or a child in general that was going to inherit the estate and all this money. Then that child starts to develop an ailment or a disability, and all of a sudden it becomes very hard to justify passing all that wealth on to this person who is seemingly inadequate, again in commas, in some way. So people like Simon's father, families like Simon's, would have felt this pressure to, again in commas, correct any kind of issue so that that bloodline was secure, so that that inheritance was seen to going to someone strong, you know, that would carry on the bloodline. That was always very important. And we see that with their fertility issues as well, the determination he has to have a boy. So in response to this concern, this general societal worry that the hereditary principle relied on strong, healthy bloodlines, families like Simon's would either hide away people within the family that had ailments, or they would seek out facilities that could correct these diagnoses. So we see in season one, Simon's father referred to Simon as an idiot, which for us is just kind of a passing insult and the modern kind of terminology of it. But during the Regency and Victorian periods, idiocy was a medically diagnosable condition. So although it seems like a passing comment for us as modern viewers when we're watching Bridgerton, when you understand the history behind the word, what Simon's father is essentially saying is that because Simon struggles with his speech, it must have some kind of root in mental disability. And often anybody that presented with any physical speech, sight or hearing impediments was automatically assumed to have some kind of intellectual disability. And of course, this is wildly incorrect. So Simon would have been hidden away. He would have been treated like he couldn't understand anything that was being said. I imagine in real life cases like Simon's, people would have talked about him like he wasn't in the room, which still happens quite frequently today with people with disabilities. And a lot of people were treated at home, but a lot of people were also put into facilities for the duration of their life. And speech disfluency, which is the medical terminology for an impediment like Simon's during the period, was treated at best with repetitive speech lessons. So we see that scene with Simon and his tutor, where she's saying actually he's learned his letters quicker than other children and he can read and write at an accelerated rate. Often that's the case, because any kind of disability or ailment, you adapt to it, you find other ways and you become more proficient in alternative ways of communicating. But tutors like the one that we see in Bridgerton were for the privileged and the wealthy. So that was the ideal way of treating an impediment like Simon's at the time. At worst, at the opposite end of the scale, children would have have been treated with physical punishment as a way to encourage them not to stutter or stammer or whatever the particular speech impediment tended to be. But it's hard to find concrete accounts of these things happening. So we know the broad spectrum of kind of best and worst treatments for children with speech impediments, but without specific accounts, it's hard to say exactly what the treatment would have been. The repetitive speech lessons that we see in the tutoring, obviously, I imagine there is some route between that and modern speech therapy. I've not had speech therapy myself, so I can't speak to personal experience. From research, I know that speech therapy now is completely different, miles away from what it would have been for someone like Simon in the Regency period. But if it's something that our listeners want to know more about, Chris Eagle is the kind of expert to read in the subfield of disability studies that's called disfluency. And that's a branch of disability studies specifically to do with speech impediments. And he explains that they were often seen as the embodiment of an internal blockage or betrayal or disconnect. So it was often assumed that this child or bloodline had done something wrong, and that's what the manifestation of the speech impediment was. So if you want to know the chronology of how speech treatment has developed, Chris Eagle is the person to read, really.
Wow. That's really interesting that they saw it as a manifestation of something that had gone wrong or something that they'd done. That's interesting. Scary.
It is in the context of Bridgerton, because we see that with Simon's father, don't we?
Yeah. Mm.
I was just thinking when you were talking about family members hiding their family member away, we do have another example of that with the king in Bridgerton, yeah. Where the king kept being hidden away, and Queen Charlotte kind of, they do show her in a way that's kind of sympathetic towards him, but he is hidden away, I'm guessing, for the sake of the monarchy, so people don't know, but he did have that label on him, Mad King George, and
yes.
People said that in newspapers and things, and so I think that's also a good example of someone being kind of hidden away for the sake of not upsetting the family and not upsetting the public type thing.
So, yeah, and we see the difference, don't we, between when he's quite lucid, and that's when she's seen speaking to him, and the staff within the palace would kind of come and get the queen and say, he's with us today, and she'd go and interact with him. But you're absolutely right. The monarchy throughout generations has hidden people away because of the hereditary principle and how hard it is to justify that. I mean, we've seen that in more modern times with the Bowes Lyon family branch. The and I don't know how many yes, absolutely. I don't know how many of our listeners watch The Crown, but there's a whole episode dedicated to the Bowes Lyon cousins and a very similar treatment to what King George received. So yeah, it's quite common throughout history to hide away family members with ailments, which was quite sad at the time. Unfortunately, there's still a route for that today with modern disability treatment. But yeah, King George is an interesting example in Bridgerton, yeah.
I'm trying to think of any main character of a show having a speech impediment, though, and I'm drawing a blank. So how do you think television can step up in this regard?
I agree with you. Disability representation in general is too often, for me anyway, it's too often presented as a problem to overcome or the sole personality trait of a character rather than just a fact of human diversity. But this is a thing with TV and film more widely and just general societal representation of disability. We see examples of this, particularly with things like speech impediments, with like Raj in The Big Bang Theory has selective mutism, and it's seen as this issue that he overcomes. The entire kind of development of his character relies on selective mutism, which to me seems absolutely bonkers. And we see it again with Simon, you know, it's this problem that he overcomes rather than something that is just a healthy and normal part of who he is as a person. I mean, we see other examples of this with more extreme representations, like Billy Bibbit in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, who also has a stutter, and similar to other plot lines like Raj from Big Bang Theory and Simon from Bridgerton, he overcomes the sleep impediment after sleeping with a woman. It's often for male characters. Speech impediments are used as an ailment to represent a disconnect with their masculinity. And only when they fulfill a romantic storyline or they kind of reclaim their masculinity in some sense, do they overcome the speech impediment. So for me, Simon's plotline, although it was nice to see some representation, it felt very similar to ones that I've seen before. So it would be good in future for television, like you asked, how can, you know, television step up? For me, it would be good if disability wasn't used as a trope or mentioned as the characters singular character trait, something, you know, that needs to be overcome as an inspirational story. In reality, disability is just a simple fact of human diversity. It's something that we live with, and that's okay. It's perfectly healthy and normal. And the other big way I think that television and film could step up in terms of representation is to use disabled actors. Often able-bodied actors are used to portray characters with disabilities. And to truly offer representation, we just need to generally see more diverse casting on screen, I think.
I think that's a really interesting point in regards to the masculinity aspect of the male. And I'd never, ever made that connection before. But that is, yeah, wow. It's as if the writers are seeing every challenge that could be presented to this character as something to be overcome, just like they would any other normal conflict.
Yes.
Yeah, they're saying this is an internal conflict that this character will overcome, probably because they're subscribing to the three-act structure and the kind of the simplicity of that, or the kind of internal and external journey of the characters that a lot of script writers are taught to deal with. So that's really is interesting that you say that, because I'd never kind of made that connection before.
From a kind of medical historian point of view, from the history of ableism, it's interesting for me that framework of the kind of three acts, as you say, and the character development lends itself to that overcoming of an ailment as a representation of masculinity. Because like earlier when we were talking about Chris Siegel's work, he explains that speech impediments and speech dysfunction in general was seen as an embodiment of an internal disconnect or an internal blockage. And often, of course, it was male children that were treated more than female because it was seen as more important for male children to be eloquent and so that they could go and represent the family and they would be the ones to inherit and such. And we're talking over 200 years ago that ideology became embedded in medical discourse. So over 200 years ago, doctors decided that it was important for boys more than girls to have eloquent speech so that they could represent the family in a way that justified inheritance. And still today, now, when we watch TV shows, the trope is used in the same way. It's about a man overcoming the ailment as an embodiment of him reclaiming his masculinity. So yeah, speech impediments in general have a long historical arc of developing this connection with masculinity. I can't, off the top of my head, think of a single representation of female speech difficulty in any TV shows that I have seen. And when I was doing kind of a little bit of research in anticipation of this, I couldn't find many. There is the odd female character that has things like Tourette's and such, but they're neurological conditions, not speech impediments. So yeah, it's often tied with masculinity, which is interesting, I think, when you know the history behind it.
I was just thinking, as you were speaking, that some of the masculinity aspects, we could also think of overcoming an inherent issue with nobility. So I'm thinking of the King's Speech, because obviously that's about a monarch who had a speech impediment, and the whole point of that film, the whole drama, was overcoming that.
Yeah,
I guess because it's based on a true story, it's slightly different, but that's still highlighting some of the kind of issues within society with regards to how the treatment of people with speech impediments, kind of what they're put through in order to have their regular life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the point that you've just made about it being linked with nobility is absolutely a factor that plays into it as well. Again, in The Crown, we saw a similar issue with King George, because obviously he struggled with his speech and we see him stammer a couple of times, and obviously his smoking was a big coping mechanism for him. He found public speaking really hard. And like you say, this is all true representations of the monarchy throughout history in Britain. So over and over again, we've seen this same issue of a son or second son that's bound to inherit manifests one of these issues, and the ailment is hidden away, seen as something they need to overcome, is linked to their masculinity, and therefore they internalize that feeling of inadequacy. And because of that, it's become very embedded in our culture, not just with speech impediments, but with disability widely. And I think because of that, it's still treated as some kind of inadequacy, something that people need to overcome, which needs to be overturned, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the next question, running parallel to that,
yeah,
in the sense of this idea of speaking well, that aspect of in polite society having to be eloquent and that kind of thing, it still happens today in the divide between kind of the well-to-do and the working class, in the sense of, you know, people who didn't speak received pronunciation, the Queen's English, were kind of looked down upon. So was there ever a documented case of high society having non-standard English speakers in their midst, or accents, so people from Yorkshire, Welsh, or the Scots perhaps, and were they treated well?
You're absolutely right in terms of this idea of speaking well. It's definitely something that's become very embedded in our culture. And without specific accounts of people that had regional accents or people with speech impediments, it's very hard to say how they on a day-to-day basis would have been treated or spoken to by other people. But we can almost say for certainty that people with a more northern or working class accent would have been spoken to differently to someone that spoke and received pronunciation. Tony Grant wrote a great book called Jane Austen and Dialect, and he explains that accents would almost certainly have influenced your social status in the 19th century. Often children that became maids or valets and such in big houses would be given elocution lessons so that they could speak in a correct manner. If they were asked to speak in the dining room or anything, it was expected that they would speak properly, was the expectation. So families would train the dialect, the regional accent, out of their children in the hopes that it would get them a better job, that it would get them better prospects. And I know people that still do this now. I know people that I went to university with from when I was doing my PhD that were taking speech lessons to train themselves out of their accent. It's not something that I ever did because I'm quite proud of my Manchester accent, but many people do because it does help you to get jobs. That's the sad fact of it, is that I've had many people comment on my accent in boardrooms. So not in an explicitly negative way, but I have had people, you know, say, "You're definitely from up north. I can tell by your northern accent." And I'm like, "Yep, from Manchester all my life." And it's definitely when you walk into a room of people that all have a London accent. And I don't mean like a working class London accent. I mean a received pronunciation London accent. As soon as you start to speak, you can feel people's eyes on you. So it's definitely still a thing. It's definitely still a cultural issue. So but during... incredible.
In a bad way. And and that's something that we've seen a gradual move away from this in televised news broadcasts. We have seen more regional accents come in on ITV News, BBC News, for listeners that's just local or national news really, but they've started to hire more regional accented people, or at least they've allowed those people to keep their accents. And so in some ways, I thought that those old-fashioned views were kind of disappearing in the modern day UK, but I guess not. I've never been in one of those situations. I've never been in a boardroom full of Southerners.
So I think in general it is, to be fair, that like you say, you know, we have news broadcasters now that have much broader dialects, which is lovely to hear. And when I was lecturing, it was never commented on. If anything, I think the staff and students found it more relatable, and therefore it was seen as a positive thing. So I think in general it absolutely is getting easier, but that cultural implication that it makes you different is certainly there in very specific contexts, but it's definitely getting better, I think. I mean, Kayla, for you as someone that comes from America, you must notice this quite a lot in England. We have so many regional accents.
Oh, yes. Yes, you can live 2 miles down the road and have a different accent. So
that must be crazy for you when you first moved here, though.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell the difference now that I've lived here about 10 years. But when I first moved here, everybody sounded similar or the same. But now I can definitely tell the difference between somebody who's from Manchester or Liverpool or where Jordan's from, or Welsh, you know, North Wales and South Wales and stuff. But if you don't live here, it's difficult to tell the difference. But once you're here, there is different connotations between people from the north and the south. So,
When you were watching like historical dramas in America, and someone would speak in a Yorkshire accent compared to a London accent, was it obviously different when you're watching it across the pond, or is it?
I think the hard part, which we've talked about on the podcast before, is that the types of shows that end up going to the US or being popular in the US, Northern accents are the help. So Downton Abbey is the biggest example for people watching period dramas in the US that shows the Queen's English type accent is for the upper class and the Yorkshire accent is for the people downstairs. Like when my mom first met Jordan's family, she said, oh, they sound a lot like the staff from Downton Abbey. And she didn't mean it in a mean way at all, but there was this kind of like remembrance for her of what she'd heard on TV. But there's not a lot of representation of Northern people being in upper class society type thing. Even Bridgerton is one of those. It's very Americanized. So everybody on those shows, if they are high society, they have Southern proper accents. I think certain shows like that can perpetuate that idea that you're proper or you're really British if you have a certain type of accent and you're not if you've got a different type of accent. So
I was just about to bring this up that I have personally been told that I don't sound British by an American. When they met me, they shook my hand and they said, speak. And so I did. And then they went, he doesn't sound British. Like, oh.
Yeah, she said he doesn't sound British, and then she followed up and said his accent isn't strong enough. So it, you know, what that means to them is what they've heard on television. And I know a lot of the shows that come in the US, if it's an American show and then they kind of import a British person in the show, that person almost always has a very like proper Southern accent. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking like Hilary Duff movies and Hallmark movies. Yeah.
Oh, I love Hallmark movie though.
I think the only time that we see regional accents in big American productions in ways that doesn't necessarily imply that they are working class or, you know, anything is that I've seen. Okay, so take it with a pinch of salt, but Game of Thrones. So we've got the Yorkshire accents, the Northern accents in Game of Thrones in the nobility there. However, it doesn't quite match up with that kind of representation and the loosening of the stranglehold that, you know, received pronunciation accents have, because that's fantasy. And so people don't necessarily make that connection in their head, because fantasy, these people are going around with swords killing each other, not noble, going back to that idea of nobility from earlier.
I mean, I can see where the American expectation for a received pronunciation accent comes from, though, because historically, that is what nobility would have sounded like. That is what wealthy families would have sounded like. So, of course, that's what's reflected in the TV shows, because it's historically accurate. So it does make sense. But I mean, you've both mentioned the two examples I could think of regional accents, because like regional accents being connected to a person that either climbs to wealth or already is a noble family. So obviously Game of Thrones, like you said, we see it with the Starks, but it's like you say, it's fantasy, so it's slightly removed. And the only other example I could think of was Downton Abbey, where we see Branson, who obviously has an Irish accent, but again, he begins as the staff and he slowly becomes part of the family. There's still that implication that he's not one of them, in inverted commas. He's climbed to that social position, he wasn't born into it. So, but I mean, they're the only ones I could think of off the top of my head. But I mean, ideally, you should ask someone that specializes in regional accent, because they could probably answer that question much better for you than I can.
It's really interesting.
I was just going to say the exact same thing.
We've gone on a tangent, though. So sometimes the lack of an heir in a family or a disability or deformity could be blamed on religious reasons because of the lack of knowledge around medical conditions. Could this be applied to something like speech impediments?
The short answer is yes. And I think it's interesting to explore the wider implication that disability and ailment in general was some kind of response to a wrongdoing or a sin. That was certainly the implication in earlier decades of the 19th century. But throughout the 19th century, we see that tide turn. So as the tide of faith turns in general in the 19th century, in the later decades, we see the justification for disability and deformity and ailment within families change with the development of medical knowledge. So Jude Knight in Deformity and Disability in Georgian England explains that in the earlier decades of the century and the latter decades of the century before, disability and affliction was often viewed as part of God's will. So positive or negative, it was either seen as a test of the family's faith, which was sometimes a positive thing. They were seen as a family chosen by God to be tested and therefore were more worthy in some way. This was often wealthy families. who, of course, could never have done anything wrong or committed a sin. So God had chosen them to test. So it was seen as God's will in that sense. Or the more negative implication, unfortunately, of religious reasoning was that it was a punishment because of some kind of sin or discrepancy that the family had committed. And because speech impediments were seen as a type of mental affliction or some kind of disconnect, particularly with masculinity, like we were talking about earlier, they would almost certainly have been categorized as God's will in response to a sin. It was almost always considered a punishment from what I've seen. From letters that have been written and such, any disability or ailment that was seen as socially undesirable was often in the earlier decades seen as a punishment. Believe it or not, there were disabilities and ailments that were seen as socially desirable. So in the earlier decades of the 19th century, if a woman in particular had any kind of sickness that would lend her to fainting or being generally quite thin and drawn, they had a kind of phrase of women being sickly looking. It was very in fashion for women to appear in that way. So it was quite fashionable. That was often for wealthy families that had lots of daughters that needed to be married off. If girls presented in that way, it was seen as a socially fashionable ailment, and therefore God must have sent it to test the family because the family was special in some way. They were chosen by God to be worthy to have their faith tested. And therefore these girls were seen as an embodiment of femininity and delicacy. And so they were married off quite quickly and seen as quite desirable on the marriage market. And of course, the complete opposite end of that is having a working class man who needed to do physical labor to feed his family and developed a disability. And of course, the community would just assume that it was some kind of punishment for a sin. But like I say, this changes in the later decades. So as the tide shifts away from faith in general at large, because we see the development of Darwin's theory and we see science and technological development come on in leaps and bounds in general across the 19th century, the later decades would often put disability and deformity in particular down to a concept called maternal impression. So I've come across this a lot in my research with the later decades for freak show performers. It was the most common explanation in the later decades of the 19th century for affliction and deformity. And the idea was that an experience that had been had by the pregnant mother affects how the baby is born. So the really famous example is Stephen Bobrowski, who we see in The Greatest Showman. And he was famous as being the Lionel, the lion-faced boy. And his mother witnessed his father being mauled by a lion whilst she was pregnant. So of course, then when Stephen was born with hypertrichosis, which is the condition where hair grew on his face and his shoulders and upper body, which resulted in this long hair that he was famous for, he was dubbed Lionel the Lion-Faced Boy, and the story of his mother's traumatic experience was touted the world over by Barnum as the reason for his disability. And he's not the only one. We see this with loads of performers. There was a boy that had a condition where his hands only formed in two appendages, and he was dubbed as a lobster boy, and that was put down to his mother having a traumatic experience during pregnancy. We see it over and over again with freak show performers. So we move really from the earlier part of the century, it being God's will, and in the later part of the century, it's some kind of experience had by the mother during pregnancy. So somewhere there is always a family or mother responsible for committing some kind of wrongdoing, and that's why these disabilities result. But I mean, the latter parts of the century, people made fortunes from touting these stories, and we have no way of verifying them or knowing if they were accurate. So they could be completely fabricated, but it was a diagnosable medical condition. It was written in medical journals as maternal impression was what it turned into.
I was just going to ask about kind of the freak show you mentioned. That's what they're called.
They were freak show performers, yeah.
I was going to ask about that in terms of men who had disabilities. Well, I guess women as well. Would they have turned to performing at those sorts of things because they couldn't work as a way to make money, even though obviously it means that their disability is on show?
Yes and no. So the short answer is yes. Often people would go and seek out sideshows and shows famously like P.T. Barnum's, because at the end of the day, it paid the bills. It was, you know, the incentive was financial because, like you said, these were in general working class performers that needed to pay the bills. But the social understanding now of the experience of these performers is very much what we see in films like The Greatest Showman. So, you know, there's that scene where young P.T. Barnum is in the alley and the lady in the cloak hands him an apple. And then later on, we see the bearded lady working in the washer room and she asks to be left alone. And there's this implication that people with disability and deformities were sought out and recruited for freaking sideshows, and that they weren't treated particularly well, that it was essentially just a way to make ends meet for them because they couldn't find work elsewhere. And I'm sure for a few, that was the case. For a lot of freak show performers, they had their own agent, they had a booking agent, they had their own contracts, they set their own pay rate. They would earn often more money as a freak show performer than the average singer or opera singer and such. So obviously Jenny Lind is quite famous for touring with P.T. Barnum. And although she made more money for him than some of the performers did, some of them weren't far behind. Some of them earned almost the same amount of money. So they were independent and quite empowered in a way, working in the touring shows that they wouldn't have been if they were working in normal working class jobs. So these stories that they created of kind of some kind of sin or God's will or maternal impression was just part of the sensationalization of their condition. And yes, their condition was put on show, and objectively now, as modern viewers, that's very uncomfortable for us because disability isn't a performance that you take on and off as you come on and off stage. But for them at the time, that's absolutely what it was. They would come on, you know, they were prepared to go on stage by putting on a costume that exaggerated their disability, and they would wear a backdrop that exaggerated that, and they would lie about their height or their weight or, you know, the story of how it came to be that they had this condition. And it was all part of just marketing their performance. And then they would put on their normal shirt and walk out into the street, and no one would even know they had that condition, and they would go back to living a life, normal life, outside of being a performer. So yeah, it was quite different to how it's represented on TV and in films. So
interesting. So kind of going a little bit back towards the speech impediment aspect there, are there any real life examples of people in upper class society with speech impediments in the Regency Victorian period at all, do you know? And how did they fare?
So similar to the kind of treatment of freak show performance, the way it's represented in TV and film is slightly different to the reality. So because there weren't many, if at all, any recordings of these speech impediments, it's almost impossible to know for sure how they would have been treated and spoken to. But it almost certainly, if you read the research of people like Chris Eagle and Jude Knight, it would have almost certainly depended on their status, their wealth, and how accepting their family was. So some families would have thrown caution to the wind, not cared what people said about the hereditary principle, not been bothered what the local community thought, and would have kept these family members at home, and they would have fared similarly to other children, apart from gossip in the local village. But some families didn't want to stand scrutiny, whether that's because they were wealthier and they felt more pressure, we'll never know. But those are the families that would hide these. Often in childhood it would happen, they would hide these children away. But one famous example that we do know of, not particularly a speech impediment, but George Austen, who was Jane Austen's older brother, had a disability. And Claire Tomlin, in her book Jane Austen, a biography, refers to Jane, in quotes, talking with her fingers in a letter in 1808 to someone else when she's talking about communicating with George. And that hints at sign language, like an early version of sign language. So there absolutely were people in middle-class society that communicated in alternate ways, whether that's sign language or they had speech impediments or other disabilities. But we can't say for certain that there were upper-class wealthy people that had these impediments, because if they were successful your class, they either would have hidden it or overcome it to the point where they could be out in society. So
yeah, that's something I didn't really think about. Obviously, they would have the wealth that they needed in order to kind of do what they wanted.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about Jane Austen's brother. I know in Becoming Jane, there is a character that is nonverbal that she communicates with, but I didn't think that was something that was rooted in history. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, George is an interesting case, really. And it's because of his family's success and Jane's, really, that lent him those resources to be able to stay in the family and not have to be sent away. And that's very similar, I imagine, to how upper class people that developed a speech impediment would have been. They'd have had the money to employ a tutor, and they would have had the money to, people would have politely ignored their speech impediment because they had enough money that people didn't care, really. So it very much depended on circumstances. And because, like I say, because none of these things were recorded, what we see on television now is very different to the reality, in the same way that it is for most representations of historical disability, really.
Is there anything that shows like Bridgerton or other period dramas can do to portray disabilities more accurately or bring awareness?
I think to address how disabilities were treated in a historically accurate way would mean a lot of historical dramas and historical TV shows talking specifically about disabled people's day-to-day lives, which, although we do need more of this historical representation of disabled culture in TV, would make for very specific TV. So I would love to see more TV shows where, you know, they do chronicle the lives of disabled Victorians and disabled people in the Regency period, but that would have to specifically be a chronicle of the day-to-day life of that character. So in terms of representing them in wider discussions of society like Bridgerton and like Downton Abbey and The Crown, for dramas in general, disability needs to just be treated as a fact of life. It's just a fact of human diversity. Bridgerton does diversity so well in other ways, in terms of racial diversity, in terms of cultural diversity, even in terms of gender diversity. We see an exploration of how it's different for men and women. Daphne's character really explores this. She has that argument where she's like, well, it's different for you, this is my sole purpose. So they explore diversity in almost every other way excellently. It's just that disability needs to be included in the same way that these other aspects of human diversity do. Not every TV drama needs to be specifically about the medical treatment of disabled characters in order to just include the history of disability as a fact of life, really. So I hope in the future that disability will be represented in a similar way, and it's just an acknowledgement of everything that is celebrated about being disabled, but also acknowledging the struggles of it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, as we've been talking, I've been trying to think of other shows that do this, and kind of, it's so hard. Period drama or not, it is very difficult to think of representation of disabilities in an accurate way. So it's definitely an important issue there. So are there any books, you've mentioned some, which is fantastic, but non-fiction or fiction books that you would recommend for people to read so that they can learn more about disabilities in the past?
Yeah, I've got a couple here. So if you want to have a quick dive into the history of disability, I would recommend Birch and Rembus's Disability Histories, or Molly Seymour's A Brief History of Disability. They give you a quick overview rather than going into all the medical and technical jargon and specifics. They were a great introduction for me years ago when I very first had an interest just as a history hobbyist rather than as an academic. The History of Medicine by William Bynum is a bit more academic, so if this is something you're already interested in, that could be a great next step for reading. If you want something that's a bit more person specific, so if you enjoyed things like Bridgerton and The Greatest Showman and representations of disability in The Crown, books like Patient Voices in Britain by Anne Hanley Stoddard, she specifically discusses patients and what their lives and their day-to-day issues were like. So if you want the more personal side, that's a great read. And a great read in general is Fictions of Affliction by Martha Stoddard Holmes. So Fictions of Affliction is more general in terms of, she breaks it down into how disability was an issue for women, disability was an issue for working class, and it's kind of categorized in that way. So that's easier to identify for yourself. If you're interested in what history would have been like for you if you'd have been disabled throughout history, that's a great one to have a look at.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Zoe, for joining us here on Regency Rumors.
Thank you.
No, thank you so much.
For a while, that we thought that there are these heavy fantastical elements to Bridgerton. There are ways that the show is rooted in history, though. So it's great to get your insight on a topic like this, which was so important for season one. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's always interesting to talk about, but because it's very rooted in something quite personal for a lot of people, I feel like it can be a heavy topic, so it can be quite serious. But yeah, it's interesting to talk about though still, and it would be nice to see how it develops throughout Bridgerton. And yeah, maybe we could follow this up with later seasons, which would be nice.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We've loved having you on. And thank you. And thank you, dear listener. So until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.